Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. During the workshop, you will hear from our panel of expert speakers. We will allow time for questions and comments following the presentation. Instructions will be given at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. I would now like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Thank you so much, Ayala, and I too would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Workshop. Today's program is focusing on the treatment of metastatic breast cancer, and with information from the 39th Annual San Antonio Breast Cancer Symposium. Today is part three of a three-part series, and today's program has been a collaboration between Cancer Care and many other cancer organizations, both general cancer organizations and breast cancer-specific organizations. And it really is because of that collaboration and your interest in this topic that we have over 913 participants on the call today. So you're a very large group of people. You can't see each other, but you're from all over the United States. And we also have international participants from Algeria, Canada, Morocco, Sweden, and the United Kingdom. So it's really a credit to all of you that you have chosen to spend the next hour with us. Today's program is supported by AbbVie, the Celgene Corporation, a contribution from Lilly, Novartis Oncology, and Pfizer. And I really want to thank them for their support of this entire series, actually. And also, I want to thank them for their collaborative effort in making this program possible. Now, we have the best speakers on our call today, really just wonderful speakers. And I want to begin by introducing our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Carrie Anders. Dr. Anders is Associate Professor of Medicine, Division of Hematology Oncology, University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, Leinberger Comprehensive Cancer Center. Dr. Anders is going to present an overview of metastatic breast cancer, diagnostic testing and technologies, and current standard of care. It's really my great pleasure to turn this program over to Dr. Anders.
Thank you, Carolyn, so much. It's quite an honor to be able to kick off this hour of so much exciting information in the arena of metastatic breast cancer. And as Carolyn said, I will be touching on three main topics over the course of the next few minutes. First will be just an overview of metastatic breast cancer, and then we'll go into the way that metastatic breast cancer is diagnosed. And then finally, we will review briefly, and this will be elaborated with my co-speakers, on current standard of care and future therapies for metastatic breast cancer. So I think the first question is, what is metastatic breast cancer? And a definition of metastatic breast cancer is essentially breast cancer that is spread past the breast and the regional lymph nodes under a patient's arm or up in their neck. So breast cancer can spread to lots of different organs in the body. Namely, we see breast cancer spread to the bones, the liver, the lungs, and to lymph nodes. Sometimes breast cancer does also spread to the brain. And so when we think about treating patients with metastatic breast cancer, we're going to focus mostly on systemic therapy today, but the overall management of metastatic breast cancer may include multiple modalities of therapy. The mainstay really being systemic therapy, which really touches every cell in the body. And then sometimes we do bring in our local therapy partners, including our radiation oncology colleagues and our surgical oncologists, depending on areas of need. So how does one diagnose metastatic breast cancer? And I think the simple answer to this is typically with radiographs and biopsy. So many times patients may have a symptom or getting a scan for another reason, and on a CAT scan, which usually covers the chest, abdomen, and pelvis, or bone imaging, there may be an area of concern that represents a metastatic deposit of breast cancer. And this is typically followed by a biopsy of that site to really look at the cells under the microscope and to try to characterize those cells as to whether or not they're breast cancer related or from some other site in the body. The other piece of this diagnostic testing, which is extremely important, is trying to characterize what causes these breast cancer cells to grow. And in the clinic currently, there are three main biomarkers that we evaluate under the microscope. That would be the estrogen receptor, the progesterone receptor, and HER2. And you can see lots of different combinations. You can see estrogen receptor positivity and HER2 positivity. You can see estrogen and progesterone receptor negativity and HER2 positivity. And you can also see lack of expression of all three receptors, which is termed triple negative breast cancer. So really understanding how the cancer cells grow by looking at the expression of these biomarkers really helped us develop a treatment plan best suited for our individual patients. The other thing to note is about 20% of the time, the breast cancer that comes back in a distant organ may not look like the primary breast cancer. So it's also very important to understand, is the breast cancer that's come back in the lung or the liver or the bone or other sites the same or different than the patient's primary breast cancer so that we can treat most efficiently the breast cancer currently at hand. And I think later in the talk there will be discussions of other targets beyond estrogen, progesterone, and HER2, but I will leave that to my co-speakers. So then just very briefly, a discussion on our current standard of care. And I want to break this up into the three main categories of metastatic breast cancer that we treat clinically. First is that of the hormone receptor positive, or again, the estrogen progesterone receptor positive breast cancer with lack of HER2 expression. And in this case, we really try to rely on endocrine therapy or therapies that target the estrogen receptor to try to control cancer progression. And when I was in training, we relied on endocrine therapy as a single agent, but over the course of the past decade, we've seen other targeted therapies which have augmented the efficacy of endocrine therapy. So one of those is a drug called palbociclib. This blocks the cell cycle and is traditionally given in first or second line therapy in the setting of hormone receptor positive breast cancer. We also have targeted therapy against the mTOR pathway, which is a resistance mechanism with the drug everolimus. And then we also have other drugs targeting the estrogen receptor fulvestrant, which is an injection form. And once once patients have received endocrine therapy, if we find that the cancer cells are no longer responding to endocrine blockade, we will then move on to chemotherapy, which will also be addressed later, but there are multiple types of chemotherapy that we prescribe in the metastatic setting. So moving on to HER2-positive breast cancer, this could be with or without estrogen or progesterone receptor positivity. We try to target the HER2 receptor because this is where many of the cancer cells get their fuel for growth. First-line therapy is with a monoclonal antibody that targets HER2 called trastuzumab, and that is now being given with another monoclonal antibody called pertuzumab that binds both HER2 and HER3. And we traditionally give this with a chemotherapy partner. In the second line, we rely on a drug called T-DM1, which is Herceptin attached to chemotherapy. And this is a really clever drug because the toxic chemotherapy is delivered directly and specifically to the HER2-targeted cells. We also have other oral-targeted therapies against HER2, namely lapatinib and other drugs in development. And then finally, in triple-negative breast cancer, again, this is breast cancer that lacks expression of the estrogen, progesterone receptor, and HER2, our backbone of treatment is traditionally chemotherapy. But this is where we're also learning about other targets beyond ERPR and HER2, which you'll hear about, where we hope to be able to target other growth pathways in breast cancer, as well as incorporate immunotherapy or ways to augment the immune system against cancer cells to improve outcomes. So with that, I know that was a lot to cover, but hopefully does give a backbone and sort of a foundation for what you'll hear through the rest of the presentation. And I'll now hand back over to Carolyn for the next speaker.
Thank you so much, Dr. Anders. That was excellent. An excellent overview and really set the stage for the entire program today, so thank you so much. And our next speaker is Dr. Deborah Topmeyer. Dr. Totmeier is Professor of Medicine, Robert Wood Johnson Medical School, Chief Division of Medical Oncology, Director of the Stacey Goldstein Breast Center, Rutgers Cancer Institute of New Jersey, Rutgers and State University of New Jersey. And Dr. Totmeier is going to address new treatment approaches reported at the San Antonio Breast Cancer Symposium, new targeted treatments, and clinical trials. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Dr. Totmeier.
Wonderful to have the opportunity to speak to all of you today. And thank you, Carrie, for setting me up, so to speak, for some of the very interesting clinical trials that were presented at San Antonio. I think what's very important is to understand that we have seen significant advances in the treatment of breast cancer, both in early stage disease and metastatic disease over the past decade. And this is primarily a reflection of an understanding that breast cancer is really not one disease, but a spectrum of diseases and even different diseases. As you know, and as Dr. Andrews spoke to, there are several subclasses of breast cancer that have been identified based on their molecular profile and include the ER-positive or endocrine-responsive, HER2-overexpressing breast cancers and the triple-negative breast cancers. And an understanding of these different subclasses has really informed the development of very novel strategies to treat these cancers that have translated into improved survival in both early stage and in metastatic disease. And we've really truly moved from a one-size-fits-all approach when I was in training to a much more targeted approach that has led in many cases to decreased toxicity of therapy, which is ideal in the metastatic setting, and increased efficacy. Sometimes patients think, I want the most aggressive treatment out there, but in actuality, sometimes the most targeted and least toxic therapy can be the most effective. So today I'm going to highlight several abstracts presented at San Antonio that demonstrate continued progress in the treatment of these subclasses, including endocrine-responsive breast cancer, HER2-positive. I'm going to speak briefly about the BRCA1 and 2 associated or hereditary breast cancers and novel treatment strategies in that particular subgroup, and very briefly talk about immunotherapy in the treatment of triple-negative breast cancer. Important to understand as you're hearing me speak about all of these different trials is how important it is that patients participated in these clinical trials so that we have made the advances that we have made that now have become really standard of care. So one way of treating advanced estrogen receptor positive breast cancer is to target the cell cycle, you know, thereby kind of throwing a monkey wrench into the process that the cancer cell uses to proliferate and grow and invade. Normal cells have a well-regulated and controlled cell cycle, while in cancer cells, this cycle is dysregulated either from mutations or upstream signals causing cancer cells to proliferate at a much faster rate than healthy cells. Many of the new agents that are available in both the treatment of both estrogen receptor and HER2-positive disease target the cell cycle, and these upstream signaling pathways that Dr. Andrews also spoke about that feed into this cell cycle. So disrupting the cell cycle so cancer cells cannot grow in an unchecked way is a new strategy. And if you can think about it in the state of New Jersey, we have many different ways to exit the state, right? So if you think about a fugitive, they can leave via the New Jersey Turnpike, 287. And if we throw up additional roadblocks, it then inhibits the exit of these fugitives. And we can think about cancer in the same way. By targeting different pathways, we begin to really, you know, quell their growth. So again, not just one particular pathway, but multiple pathways. So in July of 2012, the FDA approved a drug called Everolimus that Dr. Andrews spoke to that targets this mTOR that is a player in an important signaling pathway regulating the cell cycle. The drug was combined with an aromatase inhibitor called exemestane or aromasin that gave a new option in the treatment of hormone-positive breast cancer, and this led to a delay of having to initiate chemotherapy. And many of you may have been on this combination. This year at San Antonio, data was presented combining this novel agent with other active hormone-blocking drugs in breast cancer, again called fulvestrant or falzodex, that down-regulates the estrogen receptor. The combination of fulvestrant plus the mTOR inhibitor Everolimus has doubled the progression-free survival compared to fulvestrant alone in women with postmenopausal hormone-positive HER2-negative breast cancer that was resistant to aromatase inhibitor therapy. The combination, not surprisingly, had a bit more toxicity in managing the adverse events due to some of these novel agents, although targeting, we don't necessarily call them chemotherapy, they may have some side effects that are similar to chemotherapy. And this is really a learning curve. But this combination represents a new option for postmenopausal women with hormone receptor breast cancer that do become resistant to hormonal therapy. Another class of agents that target this PI3 kinase signaling pathway are the PI3 kinase inhibitors. They work on a different part of the pathway, right, a different road than the mTOR inhibitors. And one study using a PI3 kinase inhibitor called duparlisib was presented at San Antonio as well. And activation of this pathway is a hallmark of hormone receptor positive breast cancers that are resistant to endocrine therapy, and approximately 35% of hormone receptor positive patients have these particular mutations or PI3 kinase mutations. And preclinical data in the lab, and clinical data have suggested that combining these inhibitors with endocrine therapy may provide clinical benefit in this setting. The BEL-2 trial is the first randomized trial to assess the safety and the effectiveness of this drug called duparlisib in combination with fulvestrant in patients with hormone receptor positive breast cancer. There were over 1,000 patients who progressed on or after treatment with an aromatase inhibitor who were included in the study. This inhibitor combined with fulvestrant extended survival in postmenopausal women with breast cancer that had progressed on previous treatment with an aromatase inhibitor and the mTOR inhibitor Everolimus that we both spoke about. And however, we're always looking for ways to better identify patients that may be appropriate for these novel therapies, and it seems that the results were best in patients who had PI3 kinase mutated breast cancers, but ongoing research is still necessary. These trials are early, and we're still exploring the use of these agents in combination with more of our standard agents in the treatment of patients with metastatic disease. Again, because there were toxicities associated with duparlisib, we are looking at other agents in this class that may have a more favorable toxicity profile. Moving on to the HER2-positive patient population, there was an interesting presentation combining the two agents that you just heard about, the two antibodies, monoclonal antibodies, trastuzumab and pertuzumab, combining that with hormonal therapy. And the rationale for doing this was really based on a previous trial called the TANDEM trial, which looked at the combination of trastuzumab with anastrozole. And this actually had a significantly improved progression-free survival. As Dr. Andrews spoke about, the CLEOPATRA trial, which combined chemotherapy with these dual inhibitors, demonstrated a significantly improved progression-free and overall survival. The authors thought that combining the two antibodies plus an aromatase inhibitor could therefore offer an additional benefits and less toxic alternative to chemotherapy. This was the PERTAIN trial that looked at the combination of pertuzumab and trastuzumab plus an aromatase inhibitor, and this was compared to trastuzumab plus endocrine therapy. And what we found from this study is that the combination, not surprisingly, yielded a longer progression-free survival and more durable responses. So for those patients with minimal disease or patients that are a bit more frail, it gives another opportunity to treat without chemotherapy. Finally, an interesting study was conducted in women who developed breast cancer because of a mutation in the breast cancer 1 or breast cancer 2 gene. As many of you know, people who inherit mutations in the BRCA1 or BRCA2 gene are at increased risk not only for breast cancer but other cancers as well, including ovarian cancer. And what we do know about cells that have these mutations is that they have a decreased ability to repair themselves. And if they can't repair themselves, then they're going to die. And this is what we ultimately want. preclinical data have shown that blocking this second way that the cells repair themselves using a PARP inhibitor makes the cells more susceptible to the effects of chemotherapy of agents such as carboplatin. So in a phase 2 trial, adding a PARP inhibitor called veloparib to chemotherapy significantly improved the overall response rate in patients with BRCA mutant breast cancer and did not increase adverse events. There is a larger phase 3 trial called the Brocade trial that is ongoing that will really provide more definitive answers as to whether this particular PARP inhibitor should become part of the routine care in the BRCA1 and 2 population. And finally, I just want to make a few comments about immunotherapy in triple-negative breast cancer. The promise of immunotherapy in certain types of cancer has been thematic in most of our major meetings, an extraordinarily exciting area of research. These approaches, however, in terms of leveraging the immune system, has been most effective in tumors like melanoma and kidney cancer. However, results from early phase trials suggest that this program DEP1, or PD-1, inhibitor pembrolizumab has activity and acceptable toxicity in advanced triple negative disease, where there are really limited options, as you just heard about, other than chemotherapy. The overall encouraging results of these previous trials do support the further development of pembrolizumab for the treatment of metastatic breast cancer, and ongoing trials will help answer this question. And in summary, I just want to say that this is a very exciting era because of a better understanding of the beast that we are dealing with, but it's only through participation, patients participating in clinical trials, that we have been able to make the great advances that we have, and it looks very promising for the future as well. So thank you.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Todmeyer, and thank you also for that really very promising presentation, very inspirational in terms of all that is has been developed and is being developed. So we really thank you for that and for being so comprehensive. Thank you. And our next speaker is Dr. Minetta Liu. Dr. Liu is Associate Professor, Department of Oncology, Department of Laboratory Medicine and Pathology, Research Chair, Division of Medical Oncology. She's also co-chair of Molecular Diagnostic Breast Cancer Disease Oriented Group, Associate Medical Director, Department of Development, Medical Director, Specialty Contract Operations, Mayo Clinic. And Dr. Liu is going to present how clinical research improves her care, management of bone metastases, and communicating with the healthcare team. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Dr. Liu.
Thank you, Carolyn. And I wanted to thank Carolyn and Cancer Care for inviting me to be a part of this really important web conference, and my co-speakers as well. They're laying all the groundwork and stealing my thunder. So there's not anything specific relative to San Antonio for me to speak about, but I wanted to take this more global view of clinical trials and communication in the setting of breast cancer and how we can get to the next level of improving outcomes, which is really why we're all here. And then we'll use bone metastases as an example of how clinical trials have led to improvements and hopefully further improvements as we move forward. So people have always criticized clinical trials in metastatic breast cancer because, you know, each study individually very rarely demonstrates these huge benefits in overall survival. But I always argue you can't look at a single study, that we have to add everything together. And if you look at survival by decade, comparing the 1970s to current, we have improved outcomes and survival fourfold with clinical trials because clinical trials lead to the development of new agents and new approaches that then allow us to provide better and smarter care. So this is what we need to be doing to establish new standards. By way of history, the first controlled clinical trial was in fact conducted in 1747. It was a trial where it was an informal trial. There was a physician on a boat where everyone, you know, it's a boat, so everyone's living in a controlled situation, eating the same thing, working the same thing, sleeping in the same space, and they all developed scurvy. So he said, you know what, I need to figure out how to treat these people because they have to work so that we can make money on the boat. He took 12 people who all looked identical, had 6 different therapies. They ranged from cider, vitriol, elixir, vinegar, seawater, oranges and lemons, and sugar water. 2 in each group, and just wanted to see who got better. And you can all guess who got better, the group who took oranges and lemons. And that was the first randomized clinical trial. And that was in the 1700s. We are still conducting studies, I'd say better and smarter, certainly more expensive and with larger patient populations. But again, the goal is to establish new standards of care to improve survival and outcomes in our patients. So we currently, in the United States, if you look at clinicaltrials.gov, which is a government-supported website that serves as a compendium for all clinical studies, there are 639 studies currently recruiting for metastatic breast cancer patients. The reality in the U.S., specifically in metastatic disease, is that only about 5% at most. Many of the data repositories would suggest it's only up to 3% of adult cancer patients participate in therapeutic clinical trials. And it's not because patients don't necessarily want to. I think part of it is the communication piece of things, and that's what we need to be starting to improve. So the reality is awareness from the perspective of individual patients as well as providers. We need to educate people better about clinical trials. And again, that goes in from ranges from the providers to the patients to everybody. Location and access is a huge issue for some. Finding providers who may not have the trial open but are willing to collaborate with providers and other institutions to sort of provide the research care, but again, integrated care so that everybody's on the same page and collaborating around the same individual. And then working with the FDA and with industry trying to make the cost of clinical trials palatable or realistic. Towards the end of in the efforts to improve awareness, there are a number of online resources that are available. The internet is an amazing thing. It's also a daunting thing because there are so many services that are available. But again, the National Cancer Institute website is a really good place to start looking. Komen for the Cure has a great website, the Metastatic Breast Cancer Alliance. There are any number of groups where you can start to get information as a layperson related to studies. And again, it relates to communication with your provider to be able to ask, what else is out there for me besides what you can offer me in this office? And is it something that I can participate and help in? There are clinical trial matching services that exist. They're few. They are growing in an attempt for either providers or patients to feed in their information and then get back a list of studies that might be available locally or anywhere to help increase participation and access for individuals. And really the goal of those matching services is to connect a referring provider, the person taking care of an individual at that point in time, and a research provider who is directly involved in the clinical study, and then interfacing with the patient and everybody sort of triangulating around the patient to make things better and to be allowed to participate smoothly in studies and to remove the barriers that might be involved. There is a project called the Accelerator Project that started through the Baylor College of Medicine, and a number of folks are now involved, including myself. And really, it was driven by the fact that we are dissatisfied with the status quo, with our ability to accrue and conduct to clinical trials. So this is a collaborative effort. There are clinicians, researchers, advocates who are involved, supported by the Metastatic Breast Cancer Alliance, the Breast Cancer Research Foundation, and really the goal is to improve the landscape of data sharing and clinical trial availability to all patients who are diagnosed with metastatic breast cancer. So we've been interfacing with ASCO, with the FDA, with industry partners, with different advocacy groups, getting all the key stakeholders around the table, trying to improve the way we conduct clinical trials. Because less than 3% of patients having access to studies where there's a potential benefit to a novel therapy, and certainly the ability to develop a novel therapy as a new standard of care, we need to do this faster and better. So as an example of the potential success of clinical trials is how we now approach bone metastases. Bone metastases in general, in terms of therapeutic interventions, are approached with the systemic agents or the medical therapy that we use to treat all metastases. There are those specific agents that are prescribed in the setting of bone metastases for breast cancer with the goal of supportive therapy, and that's really to prevent what we call skeletal-related events that relate to fractures, pain, or high calcium levels, and all of that, again, can be associated with bone metastases. The bone metastases can be picked up by bone scans. There are different types of PET scans as well. If they are detected, again, we typically would recommend the use of a supportive therapy geared towards reducing the risk of skeletal-related events. The standard of care currently, and the standard of care was developed through clinical trials. There are choices. One is an IV or intravenous drug called bolotronic acid. The other is a shot under the skin, sort of like an insulin shot, which is denosumab. They're both effective agents. There are pros and cons to both. There have been studies to support the use of both of them. They do work in slightly different ways. But these are medical agents geared, again, towards sort of strengthening and protecting the bones. People always ask about local therapy for bone metastases, be it surgery or radiation, and those are typically reserved in the setting of fracture or pain and sort of the quick fix or trying to prevent an immediate problem, but only in that local area. That doesn't obviate the need for a systemic or a medical agent to be used in conjunction with it. And there are clinical trials ongoing for the use of better agents. So there's a study ongoing right now using a drug, radium-223, which is approved for use in specific patients with prostate cancer. And here the goal is looking in patients with hormone receptor-positive metastatic breast cancer and the use of radium-223 to better reduce the risk of skeletal-related events from bone metastases. So I think my time. Thank you very much for your attention. I'll turn it back to Carolyn.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Liu. That was really excellent and really quite an interesting way of presenting on the topics of clinical trials. I don't think we've ever, has ever been brought up before that the first trials were actually conducted in the 1700s, and that was a very compelling example to give to everybody and how important they are in highlighting that for everybody. So thank you so much, and I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A as well. Our next speaker is Dr. Tufia Haddad. Dr. Haddad is breast cancer medical oncologist. She's clinical investigator, Mayo Clinic Cancer Center. She's assistant professor of oncology, Mayo Clinic College of Medicine. And Dr. Haddad is going to present what we know about the effects of treatment toxicities on adherence, managing treatment side effects and pain, and talking with your oncology team about your quality of life concerns. It's really my pleasure now to turn this program over to Dr. Haddad.
Great. Thank you so much, Carolyn, and to the cancer care team for this wonderful opportunity. It's a great privilege. So while you've heard a lot about many of these wonderful advances in breast cancer treatment and new therapies, in many scenarios, these improvements come at a cost and significant side effects and toxicities. So the impact of how these toxicities affect adherence to therapy and advances in symptom management or how we can better control these side effects through other strategies, as well as general quality of life, these are of critical importance to our patients with metastatic breast cancer. So I'm going to speak about a couple specific scenarios, and these will include our most recently FDA-approved targeted therapies for hormone receptor-positive, HER2-negative metastatic breast cancer. The first of these is palbociclib, and this drug has been approved now in the first-line setting, so for women with a new diagnosis of stage 4 hormone receptor-positive HER2-negative breast cancer in combination with an aromatase inhibitor. It's also been FDA-approved for women who have had their cancer advance on initial endocrine therapy when given in combination with fulvestrant, one of our other standard endocrine agents. And this combination therapy has markedly improved progression-free survival, or the time that patients are living with stage 4 disease with reasonable control of the cancer. But the side effects that are added when we combine palbociclib with standard endocrine therapy, there's one that sticks out in particular, because two-thirds of patients who receive palbociclib experience this, whereas no patients experience this if they have the hormonal therapy alone. And the side effect is neutropenia, which is the lowering of the white blood cell count. And while that typically doesn't cause symptoms in and of itself, this does place women at potential risk for infection, since our neutrophils, a subpopulation of the white blood cells that are our kind of front line for fighting infections, if those numbers are low, the concern is that women are at risk for infections. And in fact, a third of patients actually require a lower dose of the palbociclib as a consequence of how this drug affects the bone marrow and the neutrophil count. But the good news is that serious infections, despite the fact the majority of patients have some degree of neutropenia, very serious infections, the type where there's high fever, would require an emergency room visit or possibly hospitalization for IV antibiotics. The rate of these serious infections is very low, less than 2%. We also think about fatigue as being something that we often see when patients have lowered white blood cell counts. However, the rates of serious fatigue, the type that affects quality of life, is quite low with this regimen. Again, less than 2%. So very comparable to rates that we see otherwise from the hormonal therapy alone. But an important observation is that 10% of patients actually stop this regimen, the combination of palbociclib with their hormonal therapy, because of toxicities. So there is an impact on a patient's ability to be adherent to their therapy. Now, this number really isn't quite much different than the rate of discontinuation due to toxicities for patients who get the hormonal therapy alone, no palbociclib. That rate is about 6%. But what I wanted, the reason for bringing this up is twofold. Number one, patients who have early stage breast cancer who take an aromatase inhibitor, who take endocrine therapy, their adherence to this is about 65 to 75%, meaning about 25 to 35% of patients actually stop treatment because of toxicities. So this contrasts to 6% of women with metastatic cancer who discontinue due to toxicities. So women with metastatic breast cancer are much more likely to be compliant with their medications and keep taking it even if they are suffering silently. And so I think it's of critical importance to be speaking to your oncologist or to members of your oncology care team, nurses, nurse practitioners, to convey these toxicities, because often we do have ways to help manage. And an example of that, so the most common reason that women stop taking their aromatase inhibitor is because of musculoskeletal complications, or arthralgia, as we call them, sort of the stiffness and achiness in the joints. And at San Antonio this year, they evaluated this particular side effect from the aromatase inhibitor and looked at a drug called duloxetine to see if that, as compared to placebo pills, would result in improvement in pain and function for women who are taking aromatase inhibitors. And indeed, this was a positive study, with the women who were taking duloxetine reporting improvements in their pain scores, better function over the 12-week period of study. And so this may be a new option for women who are experiencing this particular side effect. We've also looked at exercise and other interventions where we've maybe had some more mixed results. And I was also pleased to see at San Antonio, there's actually an ongoing clinical trial now that will be evaluating the efficacy of acupuncture to help manage these musculoskeletal symptoms and joint symptoms in women taking the aromatase inhibitor. So the second scenario I wanted to bring up is one that Dr. Schottmeyer had addressed, and this is the drug everolimus. So everolimus in combination with exemestane, or more recently studied in combination with fulvestrant, again, promotes the efficacy of hormonal therapy. The combination is better than hormonal therapy alone. But one of the major toxicities associated with everolimus is mouth sores, something called stomatitis. And this is one of the key reasons why patients have major side effects, toxicities, and have struggles to stay compliant and to stay on the medication. The rates of significant mouth sores or stomatitis and pain are as high as 66% for patients if you look at any any degree of mouth sores for patients receiving this combination therapy. At ASCO, one of our other conferences in 2016, they evaluated a new way to help prevent these mouth sores, and this is with an oral steroid mouthwash. And this mouthwash is taken 4 times a day. Women kind of swish it in their mouth for 2 minutes and then spit it out. And they do it 4 times a day. And over the 8-week period, this initial 8 weeks of the combination therapy of everolimus with hormonal therapy, we saw a marked reduction in the rate of any degree of mouth sores, but most importantly, the most severe mouth sores, the type that affect a woman's ability to eat and or to convert to a pure liquid diet, those rates went down dramatically. They went down from about 33% down to about 2%. So this is a wonderful advance in supportive care. And at San Antonio, there was another study, the very similar design, looking at a slightly different type of mouthwash. And again, we saw very similar benefit with a marked reduction in the rate of mouth sores. So the take-home message here is that, you know, while these targeted therapies are markedly improving the clinical outcomes of women with stage 4 breast cancer, they can often come at a cost. And while these toxicities tend to be less frequent than what we see with traditional chemotherapy, they still can profoundly affect quality of life. And so it's very important to be communicating with your care team about these side effects. Also, when discussing the risks and benefits of a new therapy, it's important to ask if there are supportive care options available to help prevent toxicity, not just to treat it. Ask about drug-drug interactions to make sure that that won't put you at additional risk for these types of side effects. And I think if you're interested in utilizing complementary or alternative or integrated methods of medicine for part of your cancer care, again, important to disclose this and discuss with your provider. My last point here, just getting back to quality of life concerns again, I just wanted to highlight one additional abstract at the San Antonio Breast Cancer Symposium that was appropriately titled The Collateral Damage from Metastatic Breast Cancer. And this was a quality of life study looking at a large panel, over 11,000 patients, the majority of whom had no history of cancer, 4,000 of whom had some diagnosis of breast cancer, and at least 200 patients who had metastatic breast cancer. And in this quality of life survey, those with metastatic breast cancer were more likely than those with non-metastatic breast cancer to report gastrointestinal toxicities, issues with the mouth and nose, with hair and skin, pain, fatigue, and night sweats. They were also more likely to report issues with concentration, mood swings, anxiety, depression, difficulties with just daily life functions, and more severe financial concerns. So the reason I bring this up is we absolutely recognize this as your oncologist. The difficulty is having the ability to be managing the cancer as well as all of these other quality of life concerns. And I always encourage my patients and encourage all of you to be engaging your primary care providers. And when services are available, also collaborating with palliative medicine specialists. These are symptom management experts, and every time I work with a palliative medicine team, I learn new things from them. So they really have the cutting edge for how we can best manage side effects and symptoms related to cancer as well as cancer treatment. So with that, I will turn it back over to Carolyn, and thank you all again.
Thank you very much, Becca. That was really extraordinary, and I have to thank you as well, really, for all of the detail about the quality of life issues and all the work that's being done to assess what is happening and what can be done to treat those quality of life concerns, and the importance, of course, for everyone on the call to bring up any concern or side effect that you have with your healthcare team. So very elegant presentation. Thank you very much. And just before we take questions, I just want to say a few words about the impact of cancer, of course, on breast cancer, metastatic breast cancer, on each of your lives. And from an emotional and practical and social aspect, so we've heard a lot about the medical treatment of metastatic breast cancer. And so I just want to tell you a little bit about the free services that you can access from Cancer Care, staffed by oncology social workers. So what that means is that you, and they're members of the healthcare team as well, there are many different services that we offer. We do offer practical and financial assistance, which I realize is a very important aspect of coping with some of the issues in coping with metastatic breast cancer. In addition, we do offer the opportunity to talk with one of our social workers, our counseling services, really a chance to talk about your concerns, about how to talk with your child about your cancer, how to talk to your employer about your cancer, how to think about it yourself. And we offer that both in individual counseling, and we also offer support groups, and we offer them on the telephone as telephone support groups, and we also have online support groups. And the online support groups, of course, are accessible because they are 24 hours a day posting, which means that it's really great for people anywhere in the country, and also our international participants as well. So that's another feature of the programs that we do offer. And so to contact Cancer Care, you would simply call 1-800-813-4673 or visit our website at www.cancercare.org, where you can post a question with our staff as well, someone you'd like to talk to. So I just wanted to kind of give you a little bird's eye view of the services that we do offer. And now we have time for questions. We have a lot of time for questions. So I'm going to ask Ayala to bring all of our speakers on board, and we're going to try to take as many of your questions as possible at this point. So Ayala is going to explain to you how to queue up for questions, and then we'll let the questions begin. So Ayala.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you wish to ask a question, please press star, then 1 on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered and you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. Those of you on the web may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question. And our first question comes from Jenny Z. Your line is now open.
My question is about the radiation reserve being for a quick fix. My question is about the systematic agents to help, the goal to prevent bone fracture and skeletal-related issues. And I heard that one of them was the IV or the bone tonic acid. I wasn't sure what the other one was that was being referenced to. I didn't catch the name.
Sure.
That's a little, yes.
Sorry. I'm not good at this. I apologize for not being clear. So there are two available agents for use. One is zoledronic acid, which is marketed as Zometa, and that's the IV drug. And then the injection under the skin drug is denosumab. Its trade name is XGEVA, XGEVA.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Dr. Wood, and thank you, Jerry, for that great question. Our next question?
Our next question comes from Lynn F. Your line is now open.
Wonderful, wonderful program. Dr. Howe, you're doing a great job. I have a question and a comment, if you don't mind. Number one, I was kind of disappointed that we didn't hear anything about genomic testing, particularly for metastatic breast cancer, which can have such a complicated mutational burden. So labs such as Health One, Xeris Labs, and some of these other ones that help identify targets can be used for treatment. And then my comment relates to clinical trials. I just like to represent the point of view of metastatic patients. I have several in my breast cancer support group that I work with, and you talk extensively about dealing with all the side effects of treatment for metastases and the emotional burden. But I want to support the necessity to really work hard to make it easier for these precious patients to enroll in clinical trials. It is extremely challenging and difficult, and so often there are conflicts on which trial is the most appropriate for the poor patient, and it's quite confusing.
Well, great to have you on the call. Those are great questions. I'm going to break them up into two different speakers to address them. I'm going to ask Dr. Andrews if he could first address the question about genomic testing. That's a good question. It's probably a part of what people have talked about, but good to spell it out. So I'll ask Dr. Andrews if you would be willing to address that question, please. And then for that clinical trial question, about that question, I'm going to ask Dr. Lou if she'll address that, but we'll take them one at a time. So first, if Dr. Anders would address the question on genomic testing.
Sure, Carolyn, that's an excellent question. And I think really stems off from the conversation that we had about the testing for ERPR and HER2, so sort of what's next. And this is where patients can discuss with their physician the appropriateness of genomic testing, which goes beyond just looking at proteins such as ERPR and HER2, but really looking at the gene structures that make up their cancer and where mutations may lie in the genes or over or under expression of the genes. So I think these come in many different flavors, and there's no one standardized genomic test that each of our institutions are doing, and something that I think would actually help streamline as your part of your second comment and question about participation in clinical trials. But currently the landscape is that many institutions do their own genomic testing. I'm here at University of North Carolina, and we've had a program called UNSeq, which our patients have been able to participate in. Other institutions, I'm sure many of my collaborators on the phone have their own version of UNSeq at their institution. And then there are also other commercial-based assays. So one is called Foundation One, where tissue from either the primary and or metastatic biopsy can be sent for exploration of what genetic aberrations are found in their tumors. And then together with the physician can really decide what is the next best step for a clinical trial based on that information. And that can really help triage and make this, you know, often many times confusing journey a little more straightforward.
Thank you. And for the clinical trial piece, I guess, I'm realizing Dr. Pottmeyer, if you wanted to address that, and I think also.
Yeah, I think you brought up an excellent point, and I think the advent of genomic profiling has also, and a better understanding of the molecular heterogeneity of tumors, has also limited eligibility for participation in certain trials. Years ago, you know, we would have a node positive, you know, trial in the adjuvant setting, and now we're not doing those type of trials anymore because we know how important it is to identify specific types of breast cancer that would be most responsive to certain therapies, i.e. the PI3 kinase inhibitors, et cetera, et cetera. But I think you bring up a very good point. And, you know, we as physicians need to always make sure that we are giving patients the opportunity to participate in clinical trials. When you look at the data out there, only about 3% of all patients with cancer participate in clinical trials, and half the time that's because a physician has not necessarily communicated the availability of one to them. So, you know, it is also our obligation to make sure that, you know, if we do have a specific trial, that that's explained to the patient, but at the same time, you know, we also make referrals to other institutions as well that may have access or have a trial that's been activated that we may not have. But I think the issue is that we've gotten much more selective in the type of tumors that we are we feel may be responsive to these new therapies, that it is limiting some participation. But I also agree with you, sometimes the eligibility criteria becomes so stringent, and it's not always necessary, and we as investigators do work with, you know, certain pharmaceutical companies who may be, sponsoring the trial, about making those a little more inclusive. But I think we as physicians also need to make sure, and patients need to ask the question, is there a clinical trial here or elsewhere that I am eligible for?
And Dr. Liu, did you want to add to this as well? It's really important. You always ask those great questions, and actually that whole topic is one that we could just do a whole program on.
Right.
So I'm glad you brought it up, because we could really, we need to think about it. The timing of it is perfect, because we are thinking about what to do for the rest of the year, and to some extent. So thank you, Dr. Liu, if you wanted to add to this as well. It's important.
Yeah, just briefly, so clinical trials are near and dear to my heart, as they are to all of us. And it really is access and availability. It's, so towards that end, it's not just access to the study itself, right, getting to the center where the study is available, but it's the extra trips and the bells and whistles that go around a trial involving an investigational agent where there are visits specifically for toxicity or side effect checks, right? Do you really need to be traveling back to that study center as a patient, as a participant in that study, for someone to just look at you and draw your blood? Why can't you do that at home? And if you ask industry and the FDA to point to each other and say it's their fault that we're making people do it, and so that's why there are efforts to get them around the table. You know, we're in this era of electronics and virtual everything, and again, it's collaborative care. So trying to make things more accessible, I think will go a long way towards increasing clinical trial participation. So just a small piece of the larger picture that's already been nicely and eloquently discussed.
That's such an important concept, that collaborative care and being aware of all those issues. And I guess Dr. Haddad, do you want to add to that as well? Because in terms of many of the studies that are done to better manage clinical treatment side effects as well.
Absolutely. Thank you for the opportunity to speak to that. Because sometimes, you know, these aren't always the glamorous trials, right? This isn't the brand new drug that can afford so much hope. But yet the day-to-day and the quality of life and managing these toxicities, these clinical trials that are evaluating novel strategies to help manage side effects and toxicities from treatment are of critical importance. Now, I think one of the biggest issues we face is that the majority of these trials are being conducted in women with early-stage breast cancer, such as the study I talked about with the duloxetine to help manage musculoskeletal symptoms from the aromatase inhibitors. But nonetheless, I think the majority of us believe that those results would be highly transferable to the care of women with stage 4 disease. The bottom line is many of these trials are available, often at larger cancer centers. But there are so many opportunities for how can we better control nausea, how can we better manage pain, how can we prevent complications. I think those are the most important studies rather than just treat them once they happen. But definitely talk to your team, talk to other survivors, your care groups, find these opportunities because they absolutely exist. But sometimes are not in the spotlight like some of our therapeutic intervention studies.
Thank you. Well, I actually want to thank all of our speakers. You've really been outstanding. This has been an extraordinary call, I have to say. You're all amazing. I also want to thank all of our participants who actually stood up and asked really such really incredible questions that we could then, the speakers could address in more detail. And also, some of you have suggested actually a topic that we could actually do as its own standalone program, actually, so that we can all say that we were part of this program in which we came up with an idea for another program to do. So I also want to thank all of you for being on the call today as well. Now, at the beginning, I probably did say or should have said that I know we're not going to get to everyone's question. I know you all have questions that we have not yet answered. So first I want to address how to get your questions answered. So for any of you who have further medical questions, of course your healthcare team is always the very best place to start. But in terms of just getting additional information that you would like to be able to better understand something or get someone to talk with you a bit more about, you have just some questions you'd like to ask before you can even ask your healthcare team or pose the question, I do suggest you call the National Cancer Institute. They have a number 1-800-422-6237, staffed by information specialists. And they also have a wonderful website, www.cancer.gov. And they have a live chat feature where you can pose your question and they will actually, their information specialist will help to answer it. That's a very nice way to get information. And that's also very good for people internationally or in this country who prefer to use the internet to get their questions answered and addressed. Now for those of you who would like to have further help with just some of your, issues of just the emotional, social, practical, financial aspect of dealing with your dealing with metastatic breast cancer or cancer in general, I would definitely suggest that you could start with our Social Workers at Cancer Care at 1-800-813-4673. They certainly are here to help you and provide a range of services for you that you can choose from. And I also just want to call attention to all of you to a program that we are offering actually going forward. It's called Living with Cancer Throughout the Cancer Journey. The program takes place on Friday, March 10th, and it really touches upon a lot of the various topics that we address that have to do with really living with your cancer over time. And so I want to recommend that to all of you. Some of you have signed up for it already, but if you haven't, definitely consider it. Again, I want to thank you all for your participation today. I know we're on all different parts of the country, so different temperatures, different time zones, but we all came together for today's program, and I want to thank you for that. And I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop, and you may now disconnect. Everyone, have a great day.